Florida is used to hurricanes. Names like Francis, Charlie, Ivan, Wilma, Hermine, Andrew, they're not just for kids. But earlier this month, the state was confronted with a different type of storm named Irma. At her peak, she was a dangerous Category 5 that threatened the entire state from the Keys to the Panhandle. And it triggered the evacuation of more than a third of Floridians from their homes. Florida public radio stations from across the state came together to cover the impacts to their local communities. And tonight on It's About Florida, we hear from Floridians across the state on how they weathered Hurricane Irma. Welcome to It's About Florida. I'm Lynn Hatter. Floridians are still cleaning up damage from Hurricane Irma and will be doing so for a while. Schools have reopened, and in many parts of the state, daily routines are beginning to return to normal. But some areas, such as the Florida Keys, are far from being open for business. In this special It's About Florida, we turn to Florida public radio station WLRN, which compiled Irma stories from across the state in this special report.
From WLRN Public Media in Miami and Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Hudson. It has been 8 days now since Hurricane Irma first made landfall with Florida in the Keys. The storm was a Category 4 hurricane, and it would make a second landfall at Marco Island in southwest Florida as the winds and rain engulfed the entire peninsula. Irma set off one of the largest evacuation efforts in U.S. history, certainly the largest ever in Florida, with 6.5 million people told to get out of their homes. One out of every three Floridians were under evacuation orders. Some did, some didn't, or couldn't. It was the strongest hurricane to hit the state in 12 years. Irma was almost a whole state storm. Only parts of the Florida Panhandle were left outside its reach. And while its path through the Sunshine State was not as destructive as feared, it left behind crippled power grids, flooding, questions about the ability for Florida to effectively evacuate, worries about how to protect the most vulnerable residents, and death. Florida's public radio stations continue reporting on Irma for their communities. Today, we bring together some of that reporting to hear what happened, the recovery efforts, and what can we learn from Irma. We begin where the storm began in Florida, in the Keys. Nancy Klingener reports from Key West.
As Irma was coming at the Keys, I actually managed to get a couple hours of sleep. This was surprising since the wind was already rattling the air vents in the room where I was settled on an air mattress with my husband and our dog, but essential because I had not slept at all the night before. I woke up around 3:30, went on the radio, and started reorganizing my stuff. Again. The day before, I'd reduced my life to 4 bags. Now, it was down to 1, the 1 bag I could take into the stairwell in case the windows blew out. We still had cell service somehow, so we watched as Irma's eye aimed at the Keys just to the east of us. At least that put us on the less dirty side of the storm. And it was coming in at low tide. Another blessing. The building felt solid. You could feel it buffet from the gusts. But it wasn't like the sway I've felt in an old wooden conch house in much lesser winds. In late morning, after the worst had passed, we looked around. The water never reached us in Old Town Key West. There were some big trees down, but most buildings that hadn't been hit by one of them looked okay. We knew Irma's eye had passed to our east, but didn't know which areas were worst hit. Within a day or two, we found out. It was the Lower Keys. That's where Anthony Attilio was. I met Attilio on Thursday on Big Pine Key, about 30 miles east of Key West. He was at work at the Winn-Dixie.
I was in a trailer at the end of Avenue C.
And what happened?
Trailer blew apart around 6 in the morning. We lost one wall, then the roof, and the other wall. Me and my roommate were hanging on to a pole outside, said our goodbyes, because we didn't think we were going to make it. But we did, and we came up here.
Attilio knew some of his co-workers were spending the storm inside the Winn-Dixie. He waded through the receding storm surge and made it to the store. He's been working there nonstop ever since. Big Pine took the brunt of Irma.
I'm from here. My family's from here. I'm a lifelong resident. And it was just shocking, sad to see everything. Everything that I know growing up here is gone. Nothing looks the same and never will. And it's really upsetting. But we'll rebuild. We're conks. We're tough. We'll rebuild. Everything will be okay.
Some of the biggest challenges right after the storm were navigation and communication. Navigation because almost every street was blocked by trees or big branches. A lot of them had lines of some kind drooped across, low enough to catch on your car or even your nose. Communication, because everyone wanted to let our loved ones know we were alive, and of course power and cell service were knocked out. On Sunday, I got a quick phone call through to an editor in Miami, thanks to a friend with a satellite modem. We made it through to our house and found it unscathed, though our yard was an impenetrable tangle of fishtail palms and mahogany branches. A week later, it still is. We just removed enough to give us access and figured the rest can wait until we have 911 and better medical services. So yeah, the medical services. In the days after the storm, that felt like the sketchiest and scariest part of our situation. All of us who stayed did so at our own risk. Communications were down, so there was no way to summon help. People who needed medical assistance showed up in person at the fire stations. Some of us remembered about landlines, true landlines, not the kind installed now that need internet service to work. A friend has a small hotel that was in really good shape after the storm. And Sunday evening, we figured out that they had a fax line we could use to call out. That was my first connection to report back to the mainland. Getting around is still an issue. I'm always careful riding my bike around the island, but now I'm riding super defensively. I made my priorities personal safety, then journalism. That means staying hydrated, avoiding getting overheated, remembering to eat on a regular basis. Power returned for some of us amazingly fast. We got ours on Thursday. But water has been a problem in the Lower Keys, with a boil water notice, and in Key West at least, a couple hours during the day when we can shower and flush toilets. For some people, that initial period was just too much. When my husband and I were heading up to Big Pine Key on Thursday, we passed two women walking along the overseas highway on Big Coppet Key.
There's no other way out. No way out, so we're going to walk.
We pulled over and met Stacy Young and Cherie Pruitt. They were walking to the mainland from Key West. Even in good conditions, that's a three-hour drive.
Right now, there's still no lights. No power. It is coming on little by little, but water comes on twice a day. I can't do that. I have too many health problems to stay there, and it's too hot. Can't come out after it gets dark. So, no. I'll be back when it's put back together.
Young and Pruitt each had a rolling case, one for water and food, one for clothes. Young had her medications for asthma, high blood pressure, and a bad knee. She had a bike light on her cane, and she was carrying a bag with her Yorkshire Terrier, Gucci. We gave them a ride to Big Pine Key. We offered to drop them at the station where the National Guard was giving out food and water, but they wanted to head up the road.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. Be careful.
We last saw them rolling their cases toward the Spanish Harbor Bridge, which goes from Big Pine Key towards Marathon. We were hoping other people would give them rides along the way. I emailed Young to see if they made it out okay, but as of Sunday afternoon, had not heard from her. I'm Nancy Klingener in Key West.
Hurricanes expose weaknesses, and one of those vulnerabilities with tragic consequences is emergency electricity at nursing homes. Eight elderly residents at a facility in Hollywood died Wednesday, 3 days after Irma hit South Florida. A criminal investigation has begun, and Governor Rick Scott has ordered all assisted living facilities and nursing homes now to have generators and fuel to power air conditioners for at least 4 days. The tragedy has brought focus again on ensuring nursing homes and other care facilities have power after the storms. Here's Kate Stein in Miami.
After major storms like Irma, utility companies have a priority list for who gets power back. First up, critical infrastructure like hospitals, emergency operation centers, some correctional facilities, and some nursing homes. The rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills was not classified as critical infrastructure.
Determining priorities for restoration is something that's done in advance of hurricane season in partnership with communities.
With communities, says Brian Garner. He's with Florida Power and Light, the nursing home's power provider. Garner and Broward County Mayor Barbara Sharif say the nursing home was in a second tier of infrastructure, behind critical, but ahead of residential homes.
It doesn't matter what tier they fell in FPL, the administrators, the owners of that facility, and the people that were present taking care of those patients that should have reacted in the appropriate manner.
After they lost power, staff at the facility filed a service request to FPNL. Broward emergency officials say they got that request upgraded to a mission-critical status. Nursing home administrators did not respond to an interview request, but a spokesman provided a timeline of events in which the administrators say they were told last Monday FPNL was on the way, and told that again on Tuesday after the air conditioning still hadn't been restored.
there to call 911 if they can't help those patients.
The center is across from a hospital that had power. The spokesman said nursing home administrators requested and received spot coolers from the hospital on Tuesday. The timeline says they first contacted emergency responders on Wednesday morning when patients had trouble breathing and heart problems. Current state regulations require nursing homes to have alternate forms of power, but that could be battery-operated fans instead of air conditioning. I'm Kate Stein in Miami.
Deaths at the Rehabilitation Center of Hollywood Hills have brought renewed calls for state legislative action, even as new federal rules for backup power and air conditioning at nursing homes are set to begin this fall. Here's Abe Abaraya from WMFE in Orlando.
It's the middle of the day in DeLand, a city between Orlando and Daytona Beach. Temperatures today are in the 90s. At the Good Samaritan Society, Florida Lutheran Retirement Community, the doors are wide open. You can hear the hum of a generator that provides emergency power, but it isn't big enough to run the air conditioning. 92-year-old Mary Mosley is standing at the front desk, chatting with the staff and going through old photos. She's found one of her back in Michigan. She's posing with a snowman.
This is snow. This is where you live for the snow days.
It's been 3 days without AC at this facility, where residents live in apartments, assisted living, or one of the 60 nursing home beds. But Mosley, who lives in her own apartment, isn't complaining.
If you don't have something, they're there for you. They're very good.
So you've been able to get outside, kind of cool off and get some breeze, that kind of thing?
That's about all you can do here, get cooled off.
That's right.
Cooling off without power will get easier in the future. Right now, federal rules require nursing homes have backup power to run the fire suppression system, elevators, and emergency lights. If patients are on dialysis or a ventilator, that equipment must have emergency power. Eric Cody is with Powered for Patients, a nonprofit that creates better emergency power system plans for healthcare facilities. He says air conditioning is not on the list of systems that are required for emergency power.
However, this November, that is all going to change. New federal regulations are going to kick in that will require hospitals, nursing homes, and long-term care facilities to have a form of alternative energy source for air conditioning.
On the state level, there are 84,000 nursing home beds.
I'm just appalled that we're still having these conversations.
That's Brian Lee, executive director of Families for Better Care, which advocates for nursing home residents.
Post all the four hurricanes, post Katrina, post Harvey, and we're still having these problems, and we can't get this figured out. Will this stir some action at the legislature? Well, by gosh, I hope it does.
State law already requires that nursing homes have transfer agreements with other facilities, but it's hard to keep those agreements when 65% of the state was without power after the storm. Rick Morgan is the administrator of the Good Samaritan Nursing Home in DeLand.
We have agreements, but for example, we have agreements with some of the facilities where they were looking at evacuating, but we have a hard time accepting them when we don't have power yet.
Morgan opted to change their situation. They spent $30,000 to get a generator brought in big enough to power the air conditioning in the building with the nursing home.
Okay, flip the switch to manual.
Out back behind the DeLand nursing home, one of the directors fires up a generator the size of a semi-trailer. The rented generator will stay through hurricane season. Next year, the nursing home plans a more permanent solution. I'm Abe Abaraya in Orlando.
Still to come, a ping-pong evacuation and how not all public schools are built to be shelters from storms. This is After Hurricane Irma from Florida Public Radio.
We can learn so much information so quickly that there's just one question. What does it all mean?
9 senators rejected that Senate version of the bill.
Venezuela was paralyzed by strikes and protests.
This missile can actually travel much farther.
Morning Edition slows the news down, takes a second look, works to understand not just what's happening, but why. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
6 to 10 a.m. weekdays on 88.9 FM and WFSU.org.
You're listening to It's About Florida. We're hearing Hurricane Irma stories in a special series hosted by Florida Public Radio member station WLRN in Miami. Miami and the Florida Keys were the first part of the state to be impacted by Hurricane Irma. WLRN's Tom Hudson narrates. Now back to the show.
From Florida Public Radio and WLRN in Miami, I'm Tom Hudson. This is After Hurricane Irma. Thanks for listening. Hurricanes are a part of the lifestyle in Florida. Stuck out on the peninsula into the warm waters of the Atlantic, we are a frequent destination for the storms rolling across the ocean from Africa this time of year. Names like Wilma, Rita, Dennis, Charlie, Andrew from this generation have been retired after they hit our state. From generations past, Betsy and Donna, Cleo and Dora are among those that will never have another storm named after them because of the damage they left behind here. And before storms even had names, there was the Labor Day storm of 1935 that knocked out the railroad to Key West, the Okeechobee hurricane that killed more than 1,000 people when Lake Okeechobee flooded, the 1926 Miami Beach storm that plunged South Florida into the Great Depression before the rest of the country. But Florida's proneness to storms has not prevented our population to swell. Florida is the third most populous state, with millions of new residents jammed onto the peninsula, living and working in the paths of storms. Floridians fled to other parts of the state and even the southeast as Hurricane Irma approached last week. But many of them ended up in the storm's eventual path instead. That's not an uncommon occurrence. And WLRN's Tim Padgett reports it's causing Florida residents and officials to reconsider our hurricane evacuation strategy.
Growing up in Miami, Luis Gacitua lived through Hurricane Andrew in 1992, one of the most destructive storms ever to hit South Florida. That's why the Coconut Grove attorney recognized the danger of Hurricane Irma. Irma was even bigger and stronger than Andrew, so when early forecast models this month showed it heading straight for Miami, Gacitua and his family decided to evacuate South Florida.
We had actually booked rooms in Orlando, my father, my brother, our children, and our wives and my mother.
But then they saw Irma's projected track shift slightly west, sending it not just into South Florida, but also straight up to Orlando.
Quite frankly, Orlando doesn't have Miami-Dade County's building codes.
They were back to square one, with Irma still locking in on Miami with record-breaking winds. Then an uncle invited them to evacuate to his house in Naples on Florida's southwest coast. They accepted. Surely it would be safe there. Before leaving Miami, they took what could have been a last look at their townhouse in the Grove.
We did a little prayer, and we walked out emotional because I'm like, well, this place might not be here when we come back, and I needed my wife to really accept that.
But it turns out Gacitua's fear would be turned 180 degrees. As he and his family moved west away from Miami, so did Irma's track. In fact, both she and they were heading to the same place, Naples, where the storm's eye would actually make landfall on the Florida peninsula.
You look out the window and it's like the apocalypse. Massive 30, 50-foot trees falling over. I was getting texts from friends here saying, why are you in Naples?
It was an apt question. Gacitua and his family made it through Irma okay, but it left them and so many other South Floridians who fled to places Irma really did hit hard with this lesson. There often is no real escape from hurricanes that roam into Florida. The day before Irma arrived, Florida Senator Marco Rubio pondered that dilemma.
A lot of us know people that left. They left Miami-Dade, they left Broward County, they drove up north. Now all of a sudden they drove right into the center of what might be the direct impact.
That happens a lot. In 2004, tens of thousands of Tampa Bay Area residents who thought Hurricane Charlie was headed their way fled east to Orlando. But Orlando ended up being where Charlie did the most damage. Today, given Florida's uncontrolled development and population growth, that kind of exodus also means dangerously jammed highways. That's left Florida officials like Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez more convinced that evacuating closer to home should be the state's emphasis. I asked Jimenez about that last week.
The strategy here in Miami-Dade County is that we evacuate in place. Find a place here in Miami-Dade County that you can evacuate to.
Yet Miami-Dade usually offers only a dozen shelters during hurricanes. Irma's threat forced Jimenez to open 42, and even those could only receive a fraction of the almost 700,000 residents under mandatory evacuation. So genuine in-place evacuation means having many more bona fide shelters online, and one sturdy enough to withstand storms of Irma's power. Jimenez points out that may not be economically feasible. Luis Gacitua, the Coconut Grove attorney who traveled right into Irma's wrath in Naples, also points to a cultural hurdle. In a state like Florida, where the car is king and we believe it's our right to drive out of any situation, our attitudes about mass sheltering can get tainted.
I think there's this stigma to going to a shelter. It's the same stigma with trying to get people to use mass transit.
Gacitua says he and other evacuees will probably consider a local shelter for the next hurricane.
I think you'd be far more comfortable in a fancy high school gym than sitting in the car for 12 hours for what should be a three-hour drive with children asking, are we there yet?
He may be right. Maybe our mindset will change. And maybe when the next storm comes, we'll know if we're there yet. I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
During Hurricane Irma, public schools transformed into shelters to house tens of thousands of evacuees. As Jessica Bakeman reports from Tallahassee, there weren't many charter schools open to help, and there's a reason for that.
As Hurricane Irma bore down on South Florida, Kevin Youngman and his family sought shelter at Falcon Cove Middle School in Weston. There he found himself in enemy territory.
I think it's weird for us because we all went to the rival middle school, to Cuesta Trace. So this is kind of like we're kind of backstabbing our roots a little bit. But I guess the Cuesta's backstabbing us because they didn't open up a shelter there. So it's their fault, not ours.
More than a decade after Youngman was in middle school, he says his experience in the shelter at his rival school was amazing. His alma mater, 4 miles away, wasn't one of Broward County's 21 shelters during Irma because it wasn't built to withstand the strongest hurricane-force winds. Falcon Cove is what emergency officials call an enhanced hurricane protection area, or hardened for short, the highest level for a hurricane shelter. Most public schools are built specifically for the purpose they served during Irma, to house people in case of disasters. But building hardened shelters is expensive, too expensive, if you ask state lawmakers in Tallahassee. In recent years, the Republican-led state legislature has begun relaxing the more stringent building codes for public schools. Republican Senator Anna Terry Flores represents parts of Miami and the Florida Keys. Last year, Flores sponsored a bill to ease some of the laws.
I just think that school districts should have the option to be able to build at a standard that's still safe, still very livable, et cetera, but just not incur unnecessary costs.
Building cheaper schools isn't lawmakers' only goal. They also want to address complaints about the disparities between traditional public schools and charter schools. Charter schools are funded with public dollars but run by private companies. They don't have to follow the same strict rules, including construction codes. That's why you didn't see many charters open their doors to the community during Hurricane Irma. They're typically not built for it.
You know, one of the things that we hear all the time when people want to compare traditional public schools and charter schools is, there's not a level playing field. And this is an example of where there isn't a level playing field.
Some public school administrators have welcomed flexibility from laws they see as overly cumbersome, but they do worry lawmakers could go too far and leave the state without enough hurricane shelters.
Building codes matter. That much we know. And when we're investing public dollars into these facilities, the community has an assumption that they're all going to be safe, which is not necessarily the case.
Andrea Messina runs the Florida School Boards Association. She says Irma will likely change the conversation.
The entire state is talking about the safety of shelters. I don't think this is the right time to talk about loosening standards for those facilities.
Public school leaders say it's unfair that charter schools don't have to abide by the same building codes. Lawmakers' response has been to try to lower the bar for traditional public schools. Jaime Torrens is in charge of buildings for the Miami-Dade District. He would rather see charters required to comply with the same building codes as other schools. Especially now, he says, since a controversial new law is forcing districts to share billions in local construction funding with charters for the first time.
It would be counterintuitive to want to build a charter school that lasts any less or is less equipped than a public school because you're using now public dollars directly for construction of buildings. The other piece of this then may lead to potentially those schools being used as shelters in the future.
Local leaders worry that if more schools are built without hurricane protections, there will be fewer places for families to go when the next storm hits. I'm Jessica Bakeman in Tallahassee.
Irma had officials from the Atlantic to the Gulf Coasts rushing to open storm shelters. Hundreds were open with room for hundreds of thousands of evacuees. Some filled up fast, others didn't. These shelters turned into temporary homes with families and neighbors seeking refuge, battling worries about the storm and boredom. In Broward County, WLRN's Wilson Sayre shared her recording gear with two sisters, Shenoria and Shamaje Davis.
Shelter.
At the shelter.
Shelter.
What's your first and last name?
Shanita Davis.
Is you excited about the hurricane?
No. No way. But I'm happy to be here.
Is he safe here?
Yes, it's safe.
Do you like it here?
Yes, I love it. We came on emergency bus.
the bus was going around in a circle. I hate the bus.
We got here at the last minute, so if you need shelter, it's not good to wait till the last minute, because we had to go to 3 shelters, and all of them was 4.
We had to wait out there all day. It made all the people in line.
And I got off the bus with a lot of people, but because I was the only one who had kids, they let me in the shelter, and everybody else had to get back on the bus because they were just full. So it's not good to wait till the last minute.
And we couldn't go to the shelter that fast because we had to clean up. Do you like the hair cake?
No.
I knew you were going to say that.
I've never been through one.
But we did one time.
No, I've never been through one. It's just that Matthew came last year, but it skipped us, so we was pretty lucky. And I'm not from here.
Is you from here?
No, from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
What is you doing out here?
Oh, I love the beach, and the weather's warm. I don't miss the snow. But we got to deal with the hurricanes. But at least we got a shelter to come to for safety.
We meet his friends and play hide and seek, play with the dog, we act like we eat it. I had milk, apple, orange, biscuit. They was nasty because I don't really eat jelly. We colored, we played with the babies. I don't want nobody to go outside when it's time for a hurricane to come, okay? You can't play outside. You can't get in your pool when you have a pool.
I'm so scared that a hurricane coming. The hurricane just really bad. It's here today because I see all the trees shaking in the water.
I'm scared. I'm not excited.
The hurricane is coming. Everyone needs to be safe. They need to have shelters, have like a concrete roof, like brick roof. But my brother stayed home. And I'm really scared for him. He's going to be in the hurricane. I'm really scared for him. And we will our wish, and I'm so scared because of the hurricane.
Talk about the hurricane.
Yeah. I believe the hurricane going to go away. We pray to Jesus. Don't be scared. Everything going to be all right. In the name of the Lord.
Hey. Amen.
That piece was produced by Wilson Sayre. Shanoria and Shamaje Davis, his brother, is fine. They're all back home and have power. You're listening to After Hurricane Irma from WLRN Miami. This is Florida Public Radio. After Hurricane Irma is produced by WLRN Public Media in Miami. Reporting came from WGCU Fort Myers, WMFE Orlando, WUSF Tampa, WQCS Fort Pierce, and WJCT Jacksonville. Alicia Zuckerman, Terrence Shepard, Gina Jordan, Wilson Sayre, and Sammy Mack all helped with editing and producing. Peter Meritz is our technical director with engineering help from Doug Peterson and Charles Michaels. John Labonia is the general manager of WLRN Public Media, and I'm Tom Hudson. This special program from Florida Public Radio has been a presentation of WLRN Public Media in Miami. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Join us next month for more issues impacting our state.